This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutan, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. This week we have a special guest, well, two special guests, featuring Tony See, a lecturer in New Media and Ethics from the National University of Singapore. And joining us also on this panel is art critic, also based in Singapore, Lee Weng Choi. Tony, you're going to introduce to us the iconic philosopher Gilles Deleuze.
Yes, Gilles Deleuze is my favorite philosopher.
Just some background before we start. You were trained at the European Graduate School.
That was in 2003. Yeah. To 2007.
Yeah. And for those of you who are not familiar, the EGS, European Graduate School, is a very prestigious institution. It brings together all the top theorists of the time and they get to study and engage with them. And
it's a very exciting period of time where I get to meet most of the people that I only get to read about, like Jean Baudrillard. I almost met Derrida, but because of some reasons I couldn't meet him in one of the classes. I also met people like Giorgio Agamben, who's very famous for his writing on sovereignty and human rights and things like that. And I also met Michael Hart, who for those who does Deleuze, he wrote a book, Empire and Multitude, which is an elaboration of Deleuze's political philosophy adapted for current times. So it's very exciting times, very exciting period when I met a lot of photographers, like Sophie Kell, and I met people like Victor Bergen and in art. So it's sort of like interdisciplinary things which I sort of didn't get in Singapore. So it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess one of the things is that when you read theorists is that there's a certain kind of coherence, right? Because the text goes through all these edits. And when it comes to you, it's pristine. It's kind of well thought through. But when you have and meet the theorists in person, there's a kind of performative aspect that's added to the ideas. There's also a level of the uncertain and maybe just the noise that people will be, you know. So in listening to them, it perhaps a little more dynamic and rich, right, as a consequence.
Yeah, that's right. It's much more direct when you don't study the person, but you study with the person. So one of the first thing which I was very, it was a shock to me because I was NUS trained, so I sort of read all the stuff about Jean Baudrillard and things like that. And then when I asked him some questions, he just thought for 5 minutes and he said, wrong translation. So it got me going. So I have to reread all the primary text. So in EGS, we don't do the secondary text that scholars, academics write about in the prestigious university. We read what the thinkers say directly. So I have to reread my Heidegger and reread my Adorno.
But did you have to learn German and French as a consequence?
A little bit just to get by, but it's mainly English, so it's all right. Yeah.
But you know, sometimes they don't even remember what they wrote, because I've met some. You know, I don't want to mention any names, but you know, I was very eager.
Come on, drop some names.
By an icon, and I said, you know, what did you mean when you say this and that? And then he's like, I said that, because they write so much, and you know, there's so much going on in their minds at any given time, you know.
So there is a question of translation. I think that's probably much more significant than we give it credit for, right? Mm-hmm. Because perhaps they're better translation than others. Yeah.
Speaking of translation, Tony, I also find some of your work fascinating in that you're actually teaching Deleuze in Mandarin.
Yes.
In Petaling Street.
Oh, I see. And how do you deal with the terms? Or is the discourse in Mandarin with regard to kind of social theory and all so developed that are there no problems? They've already worked out these terms.
They do have lots of works. When I was in Taiwan, they have lots of volumes on Deleuze works in Chinese. And in China, they have a Thousand Plateaus was translated into Chinese.
Wow.
So they do have a developed scholarship. But I always have a problem with that because when I look at the text, the translations are not exactly accurate. And sometimes I have to retranslate in class. Like for example, Heidegger's Dasein. So in Chinese it's called 持在, which does not really reflect what design is. But they have a whole scholarship being built up on the word 自在, which is the Chinese Heidegger, which is not the Heidegger, no. So there is a translation problem that we need to overcome.
I'm also curious about when Deleuze, started having an impact in the Chinese-speaking world. I remember, you can see, in the philosophy departments is one thing, but then in the art world, so I would say that's probably relatively recent.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this sort of influx of French theory in Beijing, in the the art world, has actually not been very helpful, I think.
Mm. Oh. In what sense? Helpful to whom? The government? Well, regime? Or?
No. I mean, for instance, I was at an exhibition at the Ullens Center for Contemporary Art in 789 or 798. I always get the numbers wrong, in Beijing. And, there was a big exhibition about sort of like a younger generation of artists. And you look at the wall labels and everybody just has this vomit of French theory, So my art is about this, that, and the other. Has nothing to do with French theory, has nothing to do with art, has nothing to do with their practice. But it's a way of using theory as a way of promoting yourself. And, that's the tragedy of theory today, mm-hmm. I think, I'd like to ask you some more questions later about how you feel people studying Deleuze today, as opposed to, let's say, studying him, previously, what does it mean?
Let's start with some basics on your relationship with Deleuze. What makes him so fascinating to you?
One of the key things which I find fascinating, that Deleuze is like a crossroad, but it's not a negative crossroad, it's a positive crossroad, because Deleuze himself wrote volumes on cinema, on literature, he wrote on Proust. He wrote on politics, economics, Marx. He wrote on tons of things which are interdisciplinary. And in this way, he is very different from, someone like Kant or Plato, who is sort of like a tree. So he would describe the philosophy as a tree where if you don't do philosophy, then you just can't do philosophy. But Deleuze is someone more open and inclusive, where he's trying to open up thinking and he's trying to say, well, you can think through art as well, but it's just a different kind of thinking. So that's fascinating for me because my background is actually mostly in Adorno and Heidegger. And then meeting someone like this and then, being able to open up thinking in different fields. And he doesn't just do it superficially. He actually reads very deeply into Francis Bacon. Mm-hmm. He reads very deeply into Marx. And then he showed this is where Marx, we could get it, and then use it for resistance.
And this is Francis Bacon, the painter.
Not the scientist.
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. Maybe you could just give us a brief biographical sketch of Deleuze, and then we'll mm-hmm. move from there.
Deleuze was born around roughly, the Second World War, and then one of his relatives was resisting the Nazis, and then he was caught, and then he sort of died under the Nazi control. Then he was studying in France that time, and then he was, in France that time, I think they call it the three main H's. So one of them is Hegel, Husserl, and Heidegger. Then of course, Deleuze finally himself found a fourth H, which is Hume, which is found very important. So throughout his life, he's been trying to, I wouldn't say deconstruct because that's Derridian, Heideggerian term, but he's been trying to find a way of thinking which is not subscribing to transcendence, but which affirms immanence. And that's something very important which he found in people like Nietzsche and Spinoza. So he worked throughout his life, and there's a lot of diversity, from his works on Spinoza, The Logic of Sense, all the way up to his last book, one of the last books on What is Philosophy. Throughout his philosophy, he's been hunting down transcendence, the idea that there's something, a hierarchical kind of thought, where, Platonism, there's an idea above life. So he would follow Nietzsche and say that all these forms of thought, or what he called the majoritarian thought, actually kills life. What you need to do is to return to something what Nietzsche would call some kind of a becoming, which he said is for life. So I find him very positive because he is sort of what A Thousand Plateaus would call a war machine. So he's having a war, and then he's using Catholic term intercession. So he's mustering a group of people along a battle line, and then they're all fighting against Plato, Kant. So I find it is very exciting, kind of.
And transcendence is that it's associated typically with a Platonic project, you know, and we think of fixed ideas, we think of essences that don't change, and they tend to manifest in kind of abstractions. And what he wants is to ground philosophy in immanence, right? In
life,
things as they are sort of grounded. I mean, even these terms can be transcended sometimes, right? So it's very, we got to be careful.
Yeah. Just want to point out an interesting factoid. Deleuze died in November 1995 on the 4th. And today is the 4th.
Wow.
So we are, you know, doing homage to Deleuze.
Great.
Quite unknowns to ourselves, actually, up to this point.
So what's the best way into his philosophy? Because he deals with a lot of different fields, a lot of different icons throughout the history of philosophy. It's very daunting. Mm-hmm. So for beginners, what term do you suggest we start?
For me personally, because I come from a philosophy and literature background, so I mainly, you have to start with his early books like Expressionism in Philosophy. And his early Spinoza books, because that grounds his ontology, mm-hmm. that grounds his worldview, which he used different terms to explain later on in his Nietzsche books and things like that. But if you're an artist, maybe you might want to approach it from Francis Bacon, cinema, and his works on literature, Kafka. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I find that that is not so, for me personally, because it doesn't ground what is his worldview. So you might get lost in the details. Mm-hmm. So the proper way is to start from the ground, and you look at his book on Spinoza and then Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. These two books are very important.
I haven't read that much Deleuze, but one of his, Thousand Plateaus and Anti-Oedipus. Anti-Oedipus. But what was very interesting and perhaps most influential to me was his book on masochism.
Okay.
I wondered if you had some comments on that.
Yeah, I like the book very much because he talks about... But the basic idea is that transgression is a kind of resistance. I think that's the basic idea. So you can find various ways of transgressing because Deleuze talks about lines. So one way of resistance is not to go to the streets, but to find lines and to identify segmentized, ossified lines and to transgress either by cutting across or going in parallel but in a different way. So that's what he would call lines of flight. So I think that's a very interesting book as well.
For somebody who hasn't read, and just maybe we could continue in part two about this, but what is his methodology? I mean, is it pure kind of speculation? He's just sitting there and thinking it through, or does he use texts against which he reads, he kind of reads against certain texts that are already established, or he's looking at actual practice? What's his methodology?
His basic methodology is to read with the person. So although he's anti-Plato, but he would, for example, read with Spinoza and to find a line of flight which is different from what Spinoza scholars would want to say. And yet you can't say that he's wrong because it comes from Spinoza himself and then which affirms life. So his basic idea is to affirm life, and I think Nietzsche is very important for him because a very, very basic Nietzschean idea is to affirm life despite all the trials and errors, all the sufferings that you might encounter, that the slave morality kind of people cannot accept, which they want to build, a fixed scaffolding and I'm holier than thou kind of thing. So Deleuze would, like Nietzsche, would want nothing of that, and he would want to say that despite all tribulations, we got to affirm life. So if you think of that Nietzschean slogan, then you can see a lot of things falling into place in Deleuze's work.
And there are many implications to that. So instead of being, the focus is becoming.
Yes.
And instead of stasis, it's transformation, this sort of endless transformation. There's no real local point. Everything is connected in this assemblage. Maybe we can talk about that in the second part.
And also what would be interesting to talk about is that we've forgotten to mention Félix Guattari as the co-author of A Thousand Plateaus. And as a psychoanalyst, how much did Deleuze use of psychoanalysis and its insights into that? So perhaps that in part two, as we come to the end of part one.
All right, wonderful. We've touched on, I think, the broad, important details of his intellectual context, and we're talking about Gilles Deleuze this week. And we'll continue the second part, like Sharat said, in more detail. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahman, alongside Sharat Khatani, as usual, and we're joined by Singapore-based art critic Lee Weng Choy and professor of new media and ethics Tony C from the National University of Singapore, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharat Kutan as usual. We're joined by Singapore-based art critic Lee Weng Choy and NUS professor in New Media and Ethics, Tony C, and we're discussing Gilles Deleuze, the famous, iconic French radical philosopher. And we ended the first part discussing his collaboration with Félix Guattari, a renegade slash rebel thinker in many ways. What's the nature of their relationship, and why is that important in understanding Deleuze?
They actually met after 1968. They haven't met before 1968.
And why is that crucial, 1968, for
1968
French
philosophy? 1968 is crucial in French philosophy because before 1968, Althusser was the main person. And why is Althusser the main person? Because Althusser is a philosopher of the party. He's a philosopher of Marxism, and he wrote volumes on Marx. And people would call him a structuralist. Structuralist meaning that it's a Marxist structuralist where they believe that history progresses in terms of structures. So there's a historical, broad historical scientific structures which we must follow. So in France at that time, there was a Parti Communiste Français, PCF, and it represents this Marxist stronghold in France that time, and it was fighting against the mainstream Charles de Gaulle government. So when 1968 happened, the students were marching in the streets protesting against all kinds of things. And then when they marched past the factory, one surprising thing is that the workers didn't fight the students; they joined the students, and then the teachers sort of joined the students as well. So what you have is a spontaneous kind of movement, right? So much longer and prior to the Arab Spring, and the surprising thing is why, because they thought the PCF would join them, because the PCF is sort of like the opposition party, but the PCF did not join them, but in the end somehow supported right-wing party to crush the student rebellion. And the reasoning is that they did not follow Marxist structuralist ideology. They did not follow the party line, nor did they follow the philosophy. So the betrayal of the right wing is not really betrayal. I mean, they are designed to crack you down anyway. So it's the betrayal of the left that set a group of thinkers thinking, why are the structuralists not supporting us? So Deleuze belonged to this group because 1968 is a threshold between the Marxists and the post-structuralists. Because post-structuralists start thinking, can I think of a way of changing things without true politics, because they have lost faith in political party. So the basic idea is that how can I change things without an ossified system? And then that's when they really went into Nietzsche and a host of other thinkers.
And this was the point that Guattari and Deleuze agreed to sort of meet halfway and collaborate.
Yeah, that's right. Guattari was into psychiatry, and then he opened up some kind of a mental institution where the doctors are not separate from the patient. So it's sort of like a radical equality kind of idea.
This was Laborde, is it?
So they worked together on the idea of how to effect social change without any political party. Because at that point in time, they were skeptical about politics, and they were skeptical about Althusser.
And this was where, out of their combined work, A Thousand Plateaus, there's this famous term that people in the humanities will often refer and use to, and that's assemblage. Mm-hmm. And it's gained a lot of academic currency. Can you just explain to us what that means?
Assemblage in the art world sort of is a different thing from philosophy. In the art world, it's sort of like putting different things together. But for Deleuze and Guattari, assemblage is a relation between two different objects, which create some kind of a creative energy out of it. Because prior to anti-Oedipal, they already have a philosophy. If you look at Hume, the idea of subjectivity is in fact part of a master discourse. So they were already trying to break the idea of a subjectivity or a fixed ossified system. So the assemblage is actually a way where you combine your forces with someone else. So the philosophy is always an end, and then to create something which is a becoming. So it is something which is neither you nor the other person, but which becomes a kind of war machine, which is against what the state wants. Because the state wants you to be in your fixed what he would call territory or your fixed subjectivity. But when you have an assemblage with someone, you sort of return to the original stage of becoming.
So this would be an example would be Deleuze and Guattari. Is that the "and" there? Is it bringing those two together?
Yes. This is how...
But it could be two or more. It doesn't have to just be two.
It's a multiplicity. Yeah.
But what about... Yeah, maybe you could give us some examples. Just clarify how this operates. Because it's a very interesting notion, right? Because I understand how things get ossified. We know even within Marxist discourse, by the time you hit World War II, really there's a kind of deep ossification of what is so-called a radical philosophy or worldview. What was happening? What kind of examples could you give to explicate this?
I think the example can be in their... the way they collaborated on A Thousand Plateaus. So Guattari would write the text and then he would send it to Deleuze, and then Deleuze would edit and then would write something and then would send it back. So it's a process where as you begin, you do not know what's going to come. So that because one axiom or one thing about assemblage or becoming is that you can never determine what's going to come later.
So it's non-teleological,
non-Hegelian,
non-essentialist.
Yeah. So you have to allow that thing to open up yourself, and that's what they call the event or the. It comes from the outside, and you have to let it come. Because if you begin with an end in mind, then it's sort of like back to the structuralist Marxist kind of.
But one example I heard recently referred to the Arab Spring, say in Egypt, the overthrow of Mubarak, right? There's just this wellspring of energy. There's no real center, so it's harder to concentrate and break down because the energy is so dissipated that at any given time it's mutating and evolving in different parts because people are no longer like their atomized selves, like you as your individual self, me as my individual self, we're both unique. We have to kind of have contracts before we can work together. No, because the energy is just flowing in and out of us that we're always bigger than just our kind of perceived separate entities.
So the revolution could be taken apart as soon as it captured the state. As soon as correct. The anti-Mubarak forces took over the state, that was in fact the signal for their death because they eventually...
ossified. They became this sort of centralized, unified entity.
They were not nimble or the military found a way of dividing them, right? I think, but we don't want to get into Egyptian politics right at this point. But
I thought maybe we could talk about the influence of Deleuze. I mean, because he's very influential. At least, in the arts, for instance, a good friend of mine who I respect enormously as an artist, is very sort of influenced by Deleuze. But, I'm also very cautious about bad influence.
And you think there's a lot of just taking without really thinking through?
Well, so this is the the cruel irony where you have, a philosopher really about sort of let's have assemblage, let's not have the teleology or the agenda. And yet, of course, a lot of people are using now Deleuze almost like a brand, as a way of promoting their own practice, saying, if I associate with something, I kind of create Deleuze as a certain kind of brand position. And that so much of that is happening. So I wonder also, so the question is, what is the influence of Deleuze? And also, what is his profound resistance to this kind of appropriation?
If you want to say resistance, maybe A Thousand Plateaus is like a non-linear text in the sense that it doesn't offer you one single narrative. First of all, it's composed by two persons, and each of them is a multiplicity. So you could enter the book from any chapter, and then you could come up with different ideas on your own. So I think in a way they were practicing what they were doing, which is in a way what Nietzsche and Heidegger was trying to do, like to produce a non-narrative, linear kind of artwork. Yeah.
For me, I think the aim of the book is to be profoundly vulnerable, but that vulnerability then really allows for very unrigorous appropriation, and that's what I'm very critical about. I mean, appropriation is fine, and entering from different points and employing it for different kinds of purposes. But I think the very purpose of that kind of there's a rigor. I think that's one of the things that you've been advocating is that Deleuze, while it's not deconstruction, the lines of flight, it's a way of thinking very rigorously. And that has been so essential to these kinds of intellectual projects. Their sort of promulgation that happens so much in culture has been very, very unrigorous. I mean, we could have the same conversation about deconstruction. I like to eschew the word, even though Derrida has been very influential to my own sort of thinking. But, you know...
You mean the culture of name-dropping, of not really engaging with ideas in depth, but just referring to it because it's fashionable?
I think students, you know, art students are genuinely inspired by Deleuze. But that inspiration then doesn't go further to be, let's say, self-critical or to be rigorous, you know. And too often we're of a, and, you know, this is new media. So to coming back to new media, there's a certain sense of velocity with which we assemble.
But, you know, I think that the idea, of course, is that we can't, you can't, I mean, unless you're trying to blame Deleuze, that somehow he had not thought through his own sort of, dissemination of his work, that, you know, he thought he could keep the same spirit of critical inquiry and this methodology in a form that would not be appropriate. But is that really can we really blame him?
No, I don't think there's, I think, you know, what we have is a responsibility to him. So those who are invested in his work and his ideas, we have that responsibility. I don't think we're to be blamed either if, you know, I mean, bad students, you know, you can blame teachers for bad students, but you can't entirely blame, you know, the teacher, right? But how do we, in this kind of culture, you know, we have a culture of different kinds of coordinates now. The way we deal with knowledge, the way we deal with the reproduction of knowledge, the dissemination. And so, you know, bringing it also to your own sort of work now, you know, new media. It's not just new media, but it's new media and ethics. And it's really interesting to see where, you know, Deleuze can certainly come in with the ethics, but I think he also really comes in with the new media. And I'd like to ask you, Tony, you know, to talk more about how, you know, you navigate Deleuze, you know, with your new media students, for instance.
Oh, okay. It's a broad topic. So, To simplify the idea is that internet is sort of like operating like a TV station. It used to be very centralized, and if you sort of hit the TV station, and all the programs would be gone. But in a new media age where information is not centralized, it is sort of the distributed, right? So I bring Deleuze in to explain how information is in fact now distributed and decentralized. So I think Deleuze, Foucault rightly said, is in fact a philosopher of the 20th century, where he already foresaw, like using his concept of control society, where everything is distributed and in a sense networked and sort of linked by communication, and all you have are nodes but not centralized control. So if you still insist in a centralized control today, you can't really operate effectively as before. So that's how I bring Deleuze in to explain networks and internet and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting appropriation of this idea of, you know, the kind of rhizomic quality of social life, whatever, is the work of Wong Hui Cheong. I think in Lalang, I think Killing Field, I think is the name of the piece he did in the mid-90s. You know, he uses this idea of the rhizomic character of social movements or the state in against social movements. They can be intelligent appropriations of this kind
certainly,
of thing.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
Yeah.
Like, where do we go with something like that now? With the work of Deleuze? How do we take it further? I mean, do you just build on a particular spirit of inquiry, or are you kind of like committed to assemblage?
There's a tradition of the Deleuzian engagement. I mean, like you mentioned Tony Negri and Michael Hart. Deleuze is very central to their project. Kenneth Surin is another Deleuzian we've had here on the show before. What's the state of Deleuze studies today?
Deleuze studies, as usual with other studies, are like they have different camps, different groups. So, it's mainly divided into, you can see in terms of like there's a political camp, and then there is a sort of like a more Marxist Deleuze, and then anti-Marxist Deleuze, and there's also a very strong feminist camp, and then you have an artist camp, and then literature camp. So One thing about Deleuze is that it's sort of like a multiplicity. So no one camp is actually.
So this is a good thing, is it?
Yeah, that's a good
There's
thing.
There's no church, great grand church of high church of Deleuze.
How about what's happening in your Jalan Sultan lessons? I mean, that's fascinating that you're having it in Malaysia, but in the Chinese language, and this is a French thinker. There's a lot of assemblaging going on. What's been the experience?
The experience has been wonderful, and students have been quite shocked, and they found Deleuze more lovable than Plato and Kant. Sort of resonated with them, and then they have a lot of some resistance to the idea of a desubjectivized, decentralized personhood or statehood. So, but the main challenge is in translation, actually, translating to a Chinese Chinese crowd, and then finding examples that. They could relate to, and that's the challenge. Yeah.
Now, I do want to jump on that, the notion of a decentralized subjecthood. How does Deleuze account for language and our sort of consciousness?
In his work on Hume, actually subjectivity is in fact a construct for Deleuze, and it's a construct which is built up by two specific forces in A Thousand Plateaux, the despot and the priest. So what the subject produces as might you might recuperate Althusser in this sense, which is a reproduction of Capital, but the subject is precisely that which entraps you. So one of the key questions in A Thousand Plateaux and their later philosophy is, why do people fight so hard for their own for their own slavery? You know, because the problem then for Deleuze is not the state. Because if you identify the state as the source of your problem, then you're throwing responsibility away from yourself. The real problem or what you can change is actually your subjectivity. What Foucault would later say, you know, that Deleuze is not writing even about politics, he's writing about ethics. So the first thing you need to change is your own subjectivity, to let it become. So the fascism that Deleuze developed at hand is not the fascism of the state per se, but the fascism in ourselves and in organizations and cultures, that we need to first have some kind of a cleansing or ethics.
On a personal note, I struggle with that all the time, the temptation of self-preservation, you know, and I think a lot of times it's just, you know, our ego mutating inside us, but enough confessions for now.
Yeah, it's also quite interesting, and I think the biographical sketch, just a note, we said that he died today, but it's also true that he killed himself and he threw himself out of his apartment window. So that suicide coming after much physical suffering, I think is an interesting point to know. I don't know if his philosophy can, in fact, address that very moment or idea, but...
There's been some controversy because he has some he smoked a lot, and then he had some lung problem. So it's a controversy whether he actually committed suicide, because one symptom of these people is that they try to breathe out in a window. So in France, those people with those symptoms, they usually put them on the first floor. But in that case, I think he was at his home. So he was like tipping over to breathe as much. So one explanation is that he didn't commit suicide, but it was an accident, you know. It was an event, something like that.
He's also known for very long nails.
You mean he didn't clip his nails?
No, he didn't. Yeah. They're very
so
like,
he might
unclipped.
Have died by an accident.
Yeah. One more point, just since we're discussing his life. He's one of the rare few French philosophers who spoke out vociferously for the Palestinians. Yeah, when at that time the trend seemed to be more sympathetic to Israel. So that's been a really useful overview of Gilles Deleuze on the anniversary of his death. And how do you suggest we start from here? So people who are interested in Deleuze, what do they read just to get their interest going?
Maybe you can start with a short book called Spinoza, Practical Philosophy. That's a not too challenging book, and it's quite easily accessible.
And people who have no knowledge of Spinoza can appreciate
it. Yeah,
you
could approach that. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
What about some of his kind of peers who've written about him? Because sometimes that's a really nice way of, you know, learning about somebody else, is to have, you know, like a fellow traveler write about them.
Derrida, I think when Deleuze passed away, Derrida wrote that, I've lost a friend and now I must walk on all alone. So I think in many ways the French thinkers were, they were like operating as a group with the same kind of target, but using different methods. So some of them were using deconstruction, some of them were using different methods, you know, structuralism, post-structuralism, but they were all questioning the authority of ossified system and how it in fact kills life and how it imposes certain dogmatic image of thought. And so these French intellectuals, in a way, they were at the margins of the political scene, but in recognized margin where, you know, you can't touch them in a French university. So they were able to write in a way that that expresses their concern, which is how do you protect students, you know, who died in 1960? How do you not repeat that and yet create some kind of a change? And how do you affirm life? And I think that's very powerfully shown in Deleuze. And I did read a lot of Derrida, but sometimes it's a bit indecisive, aporia and things like the messianic part. But Deleuze is very clear that we need metaphysics. So if metaphysics is the problem, we don't throw it away, but we create a metaphysics of becoming. And then we need to affirm life. So that's the... that's a challenge, actually.
Yeah, and, oh, and much more of a challenge being in Singapore, I think. This message. but that's subject for another show.
Another episode, correct. Deleuze is also, I think, less ambiguous. In fact, more for her right in the necessity to engage with Marx than the rest of the post-structuralists. Yeah. Sharad, do you have anything to recommend?
Well, no, not really. But I do think that, you know, the location, I know I made this kind of somewhat facetious remark just now about Singapore, but there is something to be said about the context in which you're doing the philosophy, mm-hmm. right? And whether people can take it and apply it to their own context, I think it's quite an interesting dilemma for philosophy. But yeah.
Well, you know, I'll go back to the Masochism book by Deleuze. I'd recommend that. I think it's a really good book on psychoanalysis as well. It really, you know, thinking about very philosophical issues, you know, dealing with sexuality. And of course, a lot of the things that Tony says, you know, about transgression and so forth.
Is there a difficulty with the language difficult? Because I think people often, I think, my God, it's very difficult and convoluted and dense. And is he difficult to read?
I think that is... Easier book to read, the Masochism book, because I think the first part, Venus in Furs, it's mostly like a story. So it's kind of easy to read stories than his... if you start with A Thousand Plateaus, it's difficult.
Yeah.
Because it's
anything like, with Guattari tends to be difficult. I think so, yeah. Then the ones he wrote by himself, yeah. Well, okay, you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com and we can forward your queries or comments to Tony about Deleuze or other issues that we've touched on today. Or you can tweet Sharad.
At Sharad Kutin. Yeah, but I don't go the highbrow philosophical route on my Twitter, but never mind.
And do add us on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School in the search space and click like. Once again, thank you for listening. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Sharad Kutin as usual. We're joined by Lee Weng Choi and Tony C. And we've been discussing Gilles Deleuze on Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.